Hi, I'm Derek Jensen. This is Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network. My guest today is Diana Beresford Kroger, a botanist, medical biochemist, and self-defined renegade scientist. She brings together ethnobotany, horticulture, spirituality, and alternative medicine to reveal a path toward better stewardship of the natural world. Her latest book is called The Sweetness of a Simple Life. Recently, she's been working on a film based on her book, The Gullible Forest, which has taken around the globe. The film will be released in 2015, this year. She lives in Ontario, Canada with her husband, Christian H. Kroger, surrounded by a research garden filled with rare and endangered species. So first, thank you for being on the program, and second, thank you for your work.
Well, it's a pleasure to speak to you, Derek.
Thank you. So what is so great about trees?
I want you to look in the mirror, all of you to look in the mirror, and realize that you're nothing without everything around you, that you yourself are nothing without trees. Then take your next breath, and that will be a breath of oxygen. And I want you to reflect on where the oxygen is coming from. The great green factories of the world, the great mantles of the world are the trees, the wonderful forests of the world. They produce oxygen in a form of reaction that no physicist, nobody, no university, nobody anywhere in the world fully understands. It's something we take for granted.
And so they provide oxygen. What else? I mean, what else is wonderful about trees?
All right. Oh, I can really get you going on this one. On the evolutionary scale of our genome, your genome and a tree's genome is more complex than yours. All of the chemistry the human body makes, that the mammalian system makes, a tree makes. In a parallel world, a tree has reached the peak of evolution as a species, and so it appears as the human family, the man, the woman, and the child on this earth. We actually go in hand with the trees. They are the most evolved species of all of the plant world. And the plant world is a very large world on this planet. The leaf of a tree, just one leaf of any tree that you want to look at, is an absolute unique living system. It is unique to the planet itself. There is no other system in all of our galaxies that has produced something as simple as a leaf. And yet as profound as a leaf, because it pulls in carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere in the presence of sunlight. It changes that carbon dioxide, again in the presence of sunlight, by a kind of a dance, a little tiny dance of sunlight, which is called the photons of the sun. And the dance is an extraordinary one. It depends on the sine wave form of that light. And it fires up a reaction in the mesophyll, in the chloroplast of the leaf. And what it does is it chops the carbon dioxide into oxygen, holds the oxygen, and then carries more carbon units and forms a sugar. Then the oxygen is evolved out into the atmosphere, and it sweetens our atmosphere, and it enables all mammals everywhere, all over the world, to breathe.
So many indigenous peoples have said to me over the years that one of the fundamental differences between much of Western thought and much indigenous thought is that even the most open-minded Westerners generally perceive the world as consisting of resources as opposed to other beings to enter into relationship with. But there's a lot of work being done about plant communication, plant intelligence. When you say that they're highly evolved, you're talking about them as being more than simply producers of oxygen, right?
Well, no. Yes. Oh, absolutely yes. They produce 60% of all of our medicines. The medicinal component of the forests, of all of the biodiversity of the forests in the world, is extraordinary. The kind of medicines they produce are, let's say, for instance, if any of your viewers or listeners have suffered from any of the cancers, one of the family is called taxanes. and the taxane family is used in the treatment of cancers, and that group of chemicals is found and produced in trees. But it is an extraordinary system of chemistry, and that chemistry can get into the body and literally mutilate cancers. And all of those of you who have survived breast cancer, it is because of a tree. And the ancient people, now, Derek, we're on into something else here now. Let us begin a discussion about something. And, of course, I'm from Ireland, and my first language is an Gaelic. So an Gaeling Galuafachtagam, I am saying to you that I have a fluency in Gaelic. The ancient Irish people and the ancient Aboriginal peoples of North America, I think, did meet once upon a time. And there is a commonality amongst all of the Aboriginal people and the ancient Irish, and I'm talking about the Celtic people now. The Celtic people believed that the human body consisted of the body itself, and the soul, the spirit, it was a triad. We look after our body, we don't look after our minds, and we don't look after our souls. Now, in the world of the ancient Gaelic thought pattern, the soul was more important than the body. The spirit, the soul, was a great traveler and was more important than anything in the corporal world. And indeed, this is true of the Aboriginal people, and I would say maybe the Hopi people would probably heap on the top of the list. And what the thinking was is that the spirit was very, very important. If you have a sickness in your spirit, a sickness in your soul, you cannot have health in your body. So in the world of the soul, in the world of the spirit, there can be a communication with plants. There can be a conversation with all of the world around you, and you have to have silence to hold into that. And it is only out of silence, the solitary world, that you can listen very, very closely with your heart and your spirit to what's going on around you. And when you do that, you hear the song of the earth, the song of the seas, the song of the forests. And it does speak to you, and that's where the artists live, and that's where the scientists, if they're worth their salt at all, should be living.
So how did you... Well, before we talk about your own history, which I want to get to in a second, I'd also like to ask about, it seems to me that another of the sort of problems that we sometimes see in, you know, I've lived my whole life in the Western United States, and I've fought the timber industry for 25, 30 years. And one of these fundamental conceits of the timber industry seems to be that you can that a farm of trees, a tree farm, is the same thing as a forest. But go ahead.
No, it isn't. And for now, let me look at the forestry industry. In the forestry industry, they do need trees to cut down, they do need trees for paper, and they do need trees for houses. Absolutely, I'll grant them that. I'm living in a wooden house myself. But the mother trees, the great forests of the earth, should not come down on the heels of toilet paper. The function of a forest has an enormous function. It actually puts up aerosols into the atmosphere, and especially on the West Coast, really all over the world. And the aerosols in the atmosphere get hydrated in the atmosphere. That means they get hydroxyl groups attached onto them. And that is initiating rain, and it causes cloud seeding to happen. So the trees actually function as conductors of our great atmosphere and the weather patterns of our atmosphere. You take down the forest, you take down the weather pattern. As well as that, the great forests of the world do something else. They're the breadbasket for all of the creatures that we share the planet with. Now, when you live on the West Coast, all up and down that marvelous coast, you have all of the birds that come along and use the forest as a source of food. And the bats and the butterflies and all of the migratory species that take place up and down for nesting. I mean, a bird is as good as you. Any species of lion or any species of mammalian species, we're equal to them. There is no way that you or I can say we're the masters of this earth, because you take down the forests, you take down the oxygen, you destroy the planet. I mean, in the tapestry of the world, you cannot take all of the components out, and that's what the forestry people have been doing. And to give them their due, what has happened really is that we have not had a full understanding of what a forest does for the hydrology cycle, for the cycle of pulling up the aquifer under conditions into the xylem and phloem in the tree, and then releasing it into the atmosphere by way of respiration. We didn't know that until really the last 50 years. And indeed, we don't understand the phenomenon of respiration. So all of the scientists of the world should put their shoulders together and say, okay, all right, put in plantations if you want your tracheids going into the pulping industry, but leave the great forests alone. We know enough now that we can do that. We really do know enough. And indeed, if you have children and you want to walk into the great pine forest or the great thuja, the hemlock forest, all up and down the coast that you're living in right now, haul your children right in there and get them to breathe properly. And they'll come out of those forests with a higher IQ, so because they'll have been exposed to alpha and beta pinene for the children, which gives them an additional strength into the myelin sheath of their ability to communicate within their body. There are all kinds of things that a forest will do for you, and will do for your children, and indeed will do for your health right now. But we didn't know that until about 50 years ago. So the forestry came in, people came in onto this land maybe in the 1700s, and they licked their lips and they said, we can make money. And that's the technological world at action. They weigh and measure everything in gold, and they weigh and measure everything by worth in money. But the forest is not just money to all of us. It is also a way of life. It is also the means by which we can live. So we can't take any more forests down.
So you've mentioned that forests produce oxygen. You've mentioned that they produce aerosols. They affect the weather. You've said that they can help us with cancer. You've said that they improve our IQ. Can you talk more about various ways that forests can affect our health?
Right. Right now, all of you on the West Coast, get your bodies into the redwoods, into the Sequoia sempervirens, right? Okay? And you should go in probably, actually, now's the perfect time to do it. You said it was about 70 degrees, 75 degrees where you're living right now. So all down the coast from where you're living, all down the coast, the temperature is increasing all the way down the line. And because the mist is coming in from the water from the Pacific Ocean, so the area is hydrated, really well hydrated right now. So you go into the redwood forest and you walk slowly. And you put your shoulders strong up into the air. You put your shoulders strong and you stand properly, not slumped. But you stand properly and you get your kids to do this. And then you take a deep breath, a really deep breath, so your diaphragm is working. And then you take that gulp of that air into your body and you breathe slowly, and then you walk very slowly. What you are doing in the redwoods is you're taking, you're bathing, you're taking a forest bathing walk. And what you're doing is you're bathing your lungs and the rest of the tissues, your epidermal tissues, in your body with a compound called taxodione that is coming out of the redwoods. And that is an anti-tumor agent in parts per trillion that is now, with these temperatures and a chemical reaction, being released by these trees. And you will have that effect in your body, on your body, for about 30 days, according to Japanese research. So what you are doing is you're improving your health. and you're ingesting a regulatory compound that regulates the cells of your body to reject cancers.
Thank you for that. And let's say that someone does not live in a redwood forest, but, for example, a white pine forest or an oak forest or... let's do some other forests too.
Okay, well, let's walk into a pine forest, and in America, in your part of the coast, you have many, many, many different species of pine. Loads and loads of them. You've got, the Sabiniana, you've got all kinds of different pines. Any one of the pines, let's say, anyone. Walk in there, and what you do is you very slowly walk around the pines and go into a forest. Like, don't kind of do this around one tree. Don't walk around in a circle around one tree. Go into a decent forest. And it can be a young forest, too. I mean, it doesn't have to be an ancient forest. A young forest will work fine. Then you do the same thing. Walk up straight and breathe deeply so your diaphragm is working. And in this time, what you do is you've infiltrated your body with alpha and beta pinenes. And what they do is they are fat-soluble aerosols, and really they're shaped in a molecular way like a kind of a dandelion. You know when you blow on the dandelion stalks and they fluff into the air? It's like a parachute. And so that breathing goes into your lungs through your nose, and that actually goes into your myelin sheath, and it protects your myelin sheath, and it gives a slight anesthetic reaction on your myelin sheath. So you get a tiny little bit dozy in a way, but what it does is it slows you down. It paces down your heart. It paces down your circulatory system so you can ingest some more. And then when you are just walking around, pick up a stick and break, a stick that's lying on the ground or a cone or something like that, and just break it up. And what you're doing with that, you are releasing the endogenous fungi, which are strictly antibiotic and strictly antifungal, and you're releasing more aerosols around your body for an equivalence of a sweat lodge system. And in old Ireland, it used to be called an pig a leash. And this form of breathing of fresh, good air, which is infiltrated with all kinds of fragrances, it's really good for your body.
You know, the thing I'm thinking as you're saying this is that I live in second growth redwood, and I actually don't, since I live in it, I walk in it every single day, and I never notice how it smells, but I've noticed if I go on tour, then the moment I feel like I'm home is when I'm walking through the forest again, and I suddenly, because I've been in a city or something else, suddenly I can smell it again and smell how wonderful everything smells.
Yeah, well, and of course what's happening to you, Derek, is that you're coming into the forest, and there's something else you're forgetting, is that with each footprint that you make on the forest floor, you're releasing a whole system of chemistry out of the floor that is actually like a form of breathing from the floor of the forest itself. And indeed, that is true, because carbon dioxide comes out of the forest floor because there is a carbon exchange from tree to tree. And we really didn't know that that was taking place until fairly recently, that the mother trees of any forest protects the babies, the functional babies around in the forest itself. And it appears that there is actually a recognition, a familial recognition from tree to tree to tree, something we did not know until just recently.
So you've mentioned mother trees a couple times. Can you say what they are, who they are, and what do you mean by that?
By mother trees, I mean the older and the oldest trees in the forest. And they are the trees with survival capacity. They're the old species whose genome has longevity in it. Those trees, now for you, where you're living, they're approximately 2,000-year-old trees. I imagine you must have a few of them around you. Those trees actually have lived for such a long time. They have telomeres on the genome that actually do housekeeping for longevity. And those trees produce first-class, first-degree seeds into the forest floor. And the children of those trees, by way of hybrid vigor, have that longevity in their genetic structure also. And the mother tree recognizes those sapling trees and produces a form of carbon system into those to get them going and coming and healthy.
And I've seen studies where they have taken small trees from the understory of a forest and put them into a greenhouse with the same amount of light they would get in the understory, and they die.
Yeah.
But in a forest, they'll live because they're actually being fed by the other trees.
Yeah, and no, you're coming into something that really we know nothing about. We know very, very little about. We know and understand very little about the soil. And actually the exchange that's taking place in the soil underground. The amount of the tree that you see is the trunk of the tree and the canopy of the tree, but underneath the soil there is the great root structure of the tree, which can vary quite a lot, quite as much as the upper crown can. And within the soil, there's all of this whole system of creeping fingers of roots going into the soil. And these roots are looking for food, but they don't get food directly out of the soil. They get food by way of a contact with mycorrhiza. But where you're living now, well, and farther down the coast, there are some species that really fascinate me, and it's the Pinus sabiniana, that's the digger pine, which is a bit farther down the coast from you, which produces all kinds of marvelous seeds, and they're the pine seeds that all of the Aboriginal people did live upon. But the roots produce something really weird. They produce lactic acid and butyric acid. And I think, this is only a best guess here, I think they're using these acids, which are similar to the acids in your body, in one of your carbon cycles in your body, to get and to beg for food from fungi and from the other soil microorganisms. We really don't know. We're guessing at all of this. We never even thought of putting research into this whole field. And really, indeed, I think we need physicists for quantum structure. We need biochemists. We need biologists and physiologists. But those kind of teams have never been put together before.
Yeah, you know, everything you're saying makes me think of one of my favorite lines, which is that nature is not only more complex than we think, but it's more complex than we can think.
Oh, my God, that is really true. Oh, I think that is really true. All our mimicry comes from nature. All our flight patterns come from nature. Our food comes from nature. Our thought patterns. Even a child, when they're drawing their stick figures, you know, they do mommy and daddy and a house and a tree and a sun. That is what they've seen. That is what they know. I mean, it's the dreamers that we need to have. It's the artists we need to have. The artists pull the dream out of the world, and they draw the dream, and science follows that dream. And the dream quite often is of nature, but we are limited in our imagination. I mean, even Stephen Hawking, even his ideas comes out of the system of art. I mean, and his is a best guess too. And the same thing with Einstein. I mean, Einstein's first wife was a marvelous, extraordinary, brilliant woman. And that's where a lot of his ideas came from, in space, time travel, and so on and so forth. So we're limited by our own eyes. We're limited by our own brain. But we forget that we have those limitations. And then the people who are so artistic, our kids who are really, really artistic, they get stumped down. And we don't listen to the holy men. We don't listen to the people who can dream and who can go into the planes of dreaming on this continent, because that was a very, very important thing for the Aboriginal people on this continent. They could meet one another in their dreams.
So what is the relationship between, I guess two questions. One of them is, what is the relationship between not being in forests, not experiencing forests? First off, what does not being in forests do to us? You know, you've talked about how great it is to be in forests. What happens if you live in New York City, or you live in some city, and you don't actually walk through parks? Let's say you don't go to forests or even to parks. You don't interact with trees. What does that do to a person?
Well,
and second, what is the relationship between that and you said that they meet each other in dreams. What's the relationship between being in nature and meeting each other in dreams? So either of those or both of those.
Or any one of the mix of them. The difference between somebody walking down a street in New York City, walking down a concrete street, the concrete experience in the city, any city across the world, there is that, okay, versus the forest system. Now, in the city, there are two events take place in the body. Number one is, because you're under a high-stress situation in a concrete village, you have higher cortisol levels in your system. And the cortisol levels are fright and flight in the system, which stresses the adrenal glands and stresses your kidneys. That in itself is not super healthy for you. Then let's take a step into the forest. The forest, because of just the fact it's green, right? Green around your eyes drops the cortisol level in your blood system. It stops the stress on the adrenal glands and stops the stress on the kidneys. What that does is it improves your ability to function, cardio function. It improves your ability to be non-stressed, which affects your diabetic level, your heart level, your heart rate, your whole system in your body is reduced in its function. It gives your body a holiday, a simple, simple holiday. Then let's go back into the city again. In the city today, you have a high particulate pollution in the atmosphere. That's about 2.5 microns in the atmosphere, which comes from all the cars and all the trains and all the buses in the city itself. That makes your blood pressure go up by 9%. That means your diastolic goes up 9%. And that stresses the myocardial tissue. It stresses the functioning of the myocardium itself in its ability to act as a pump and pump the system through the body. Then let's take a walk into the forest. When you go into the forest, the leaves of the trees and the trichomal hairs on the leaves of the trees comb the atmosphere of 2.5 microns and reduces, just in a non-wind situation, the pollution in the air by 25%. And if it is raining or if it is windy, it reduces that pollution even more. That means your lungs function better and your cardiac system gets a holiday.
Well, that is really great to hear. And
You're on holiday all your life, Sherry.
Well, that's it. It's great to hear, because I live in the forest. If I lived in a city, this would not be so great to hear.
Mm-hmm.
Tell listeners about your past and how did you get started in all this?
Well, I come from a noble family in Ireland, and you can right now look up the Castle of Ross. It's on the southern, the lower shore of Killarney Lakes. Everybody knows Killarney, the Killarney Lakes. And it's the Castle of Ross, and that was the home of the O'Donoghues. And they were a royal family. They were the kings of Munster in the south of Ireland. And my title would be O'Donoghue Béire. I'm the last child of that family. And we were the great teachers of all of the kings, the high kings of Ireland, and indeed all of the kings of Europe in the 5th century, the 4th century, and the 3rd century. And the Castle of Ross has now just been fixed up, believe it or not. So I'm the last child, and my family were killed when I was 11 in a monstrous car crash, and I was the survivor. And because I come from such an important family in the Celtic world, I was taken in a wardship, a three-year wardship, according to the Brehon laws, That's Brehon, the ancient Brehon laws, which are pre-Magna Carta in Ireland. And the Brehon laws say that an orphan is everybody's child. So I, at 11, became everybody's child. And because I was from such an important family, all of the old people in their 80s and 90s in Gaelic tutored me in the ancient Druidic world, the laws of the trees and the laws of nature, all the cures, all the fishoigris, all the ability to do telepathy, all the abilities to do mind travel, all the abilities to do thinking in a different plane. And I was told as an 11-year-old that I would be the last ancient voice of the ancient world of Ireland. And I was told to bring this knowledge into the new world, which we all understand as America, into the new world, because the time that I would be needed and the time that my wisdoms would be needed would be coming fairly soon in the future. And I was to remember, and I did remember, and I have been faithful to that sacred trust in all my learning, in all the things that I have done in all of my life.
So what are some more of these wisdoms that you need to share? And I know this should be a pretty obvious question, but why is that? Why is it important to share those wisdoms?
Because we've lost compassion. We've lost so many things. This is a technological world. Everybody is measured by their money. They're never measured by their heart. Who are you? What's your soul? How good are you? Will you help me? Are you there for me? I don't want your money. I just want your friendship. It's not there.
And so is that also is essentially the wisdom, or is there...
Oh, no. Oh, my God, no.
Yeah, okay. So
oh,
okay, go ahead.
God, no. I mean, this is 3 years worth of tuition.
Right.
No,
of course.
No,
of course.
No, I was taken as a ward. I was shown all the ancient things, all the ancient medicines. No.
So what is... You know, we have about 18 to 20 minutes left, and so what is more of the... You know, what can you give to the audience in terms of this wisdom in this short time over
okay.
this technological base?
Okay. I will give to the audience. You have to fall in love with nature. You have to walk through the forest alone, not with somebody else, alone. You have to do it until you hear the trees whisper to you. You have to understand the communication that takes place in silence. That silence will reach your soul and will speak to your spirit. We have to protect our forests. We have to protect nature. I have to do it, and you have to do it. You have to make people fall in love with nature. It is the only way into the future. Too many forests have come down. The green machines that sap the carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere and make the planet a livable one for all of us have stopped. We have to protect our forests, and we have to replant them and add to them native to native. You have to understand that if they come down, we will all die. It is like the bell jar experiment when you were a young child or when you were in school. But what I'm talking about now is a telepathy with nature. You go in silence, and you prepare your soul by either meditation or prayer itself or reading poetry. The word and the meaning for poet is sacred word, sacred temple in Japanese. And in Old Gaelic is anfili, a fili, the wonderful sound of music that threads through your heart. You go in with that. And this is like Buddhism. You go in and you come out a different person. You see different things. You know what is important to you. Don't let television tell you what is important. Don't let the technological world tell you what is important. What is important is the forest and the soil you're standing on, and the sea that is lapping by your ears, and the great ocean of the atmosphere above your head. That's what's important. Your children have got to have that in the future. You and I have got to make sure that they have air to breathe, clean water to drink, food, good food to eat, and fish out of the sea. It's really that simple. And it's not the rich people who are taking everything. It's you and me have got to make a statement. And it's that simple in a nutshell. But I could go into Gaelic. I could tell you all the telepathy things. That is how you align your body and you align your mind into meditation. You take all of the things that you pet yourself with every day. Too much food, too much drink, too much smoking, too much everything. You just get yourself lean and mean in your spirit, and then you can start working.
You know, I'm thinking that a couple things. One is you mentioned meditation, and over the years, a bunch of people have said to me, "Gosh, Derek, do you meditate?" And I probably do in a sense, but my answer, my sort of joke answer is always, I live in a forest. I don't actually need to, just because being in the forest itself is the meditation. And then the other thing is that that I used to think that walking helped me to know what to write, because I would walk through the forest, and when I was through walking through the forest, I would, in the middle of the forest, lots of what I was supposed to write would come to me. But I realized after not even very long that it's actually not the walking, but it's actually exactly what you're talking about, mm-hmm. which is the trees would be telling me what to say.
Yes, 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 yes. Now, and if you think you're being very stupid and very extraordinary, let me explain that from the quantum mechanics point of view to you. In the tree, and the tips of the trees, all of the tips of the trees, flowering takes place by way of cones, which is not technically a flower from a botanical point of view, but it is reproduction nonetheless. The other trees produce flowers and seeds, and the flowers come on. The male flowers on one part of the tree, the female on the other, are one male tree and female tree, but nonetheless, pollination takes place. The call for pollination comes from a gibbane structure. And a gibbane structure from a molecular point of view is shaped like a violin. And that violin, carbon to carbon to carbon ratio in the violin, can actually hear sound waves that are about 0, 1 or 2 or 3 to 20 kilohertz. That's really a soft singing human voice. That's the voice of the song of the seeds. When people used to plant seeds, they sang to the seeds. When they planted their grains, they sang to the grains. That's what the trees hear. And the trees actually respond to that. And the trees use that as a response also to sunlight. And that kind of structure makes the alkaloidal system, which in turn makes the medicine of the trees. So when you go into a forest, the trees hear you. Think about that.
Yeah, I think that's really extraordinary, or really ordinary. So
Yes.
Tell audience members about the 10 trees who will save the world.
Well, it started off by I wrote a book called The Global Forest, and I would ask you to please read it. I'm not asking you to buy it. Just go into the library and get a copy out of it. And it is, of course, you know, this is Penguin Publishers. I'm not blasting them or anything, but they're, you know, big publishers, and I wanted this to be the prayer book of the forest. Well, of course, you know, the big boys laugh at this. And I designed the cover for it, and the big boys laughed at that because it's kind of like I wanted a prayer book of the forest thinking. So there are 40 essays in that book, and I want you to take it on a rotation of 40 days. Read the book, one essay a day for 40 days for contemplation. And when you've finished reading that book, at the end of the book, there is the prophecy of the First Nations, all of the First Nations, including the Celtic world, about the time of now. The time of now, according to the Fire Keepers, is an extraordinary time. And that time, we will have the ability to hear and to see and to join hands across the world. Now, remember, those legends have been there since the 9th century. And holding hands across the world is the internet, remember? I mean, that's what we have right now. But our children will have the ability for visionary capacity. They will be able to hear and see nature in a way that we have not been able to do. And they will come back to us and tell us what they've seen and heard. So it will be a great gathering of people. And in the ancient Celtic world, it was called Taimi the Kela. We are getting together in the great gathering. And the great gathering actually is starting to take place all over the world. And that is the book that this film is based on. And what I did is I have been all over the world, and I have interviewed some of the top scientists in the world, the important ones that I think have done the most important work for the forest and the seas and the great whales of the seas, a mammal that I dearly love, and I promise that I will help the great whales too. And so what I've done, it's a series of interviews and it's a series of discussions about trees. Now, for instance, where you are on the West Coast, you have the great redwoods. And the redwoods are related to the, the redwoods and the red cedar, the Thuja plicata, which probably are around you too. Those are the wonderful cedars. They're related to the sugis. The sugi is the great sacred tree of Japan. And that's called Cryptomeria japonica. And you have a relative across in Japan. But the sugi is an extraordinary tree that's been there for centuries and centuries and centuries in the sacred shrines, in the Shinto shrines. And there are 10,000 of them in Japan. And they were sacred trees to the Aboriginal people, too. That's why they made their war canoes and their coffins and their burial systems out of those trees. I mean, they were the burial trees of the world. So we have all kinds of ancient, interesting ancient knowledge to pull together, because that's your history. That's my history, and it's your history. And that's what I tell in the film. And I had to travel around the world to do this, but I'm going to tell you a little story about the Shinto shrine in Japan. I have to tell you this story because it's very interesting. In the forest bathing started in Japan more than 1,000 years ago, long, long time ago, in Mount Kurama, and that's a sacred shrine. And in that shrine, it's up at the top of a mountain, and I asked, he would be equivalent to the Pope, and he's the head of the Shinto religion, and I asked him if I could pray with him at the top of Mount Kurama for world peace. And we went, climbed up to the top of this thing at 4 o'clock in the morning. I mean, it was absolutely stunningly dark. And we went up there, and it's like a little confessional box. And I felt I wasn't good enough to go into the box with him. I felt, you know, I'm just an outsider here. So I knelt at the door of this little box, and he opened up his scrolls to read the prayers. Oh my God. His prayers, the ancient prayers, were like poetry flowing in water, and they were going up and hitting the sky. And it was, oh God, what a magnificent time it was. And he prayed to the north and to the south and to the east and to the west for peace. And I followed him in his prayer. And then when it was finished, the dawn was coming up, and I said to him, can you get that smell? Can you get the wonderful, wonderful smell in the air? The smell was out of this world, which were down to the ground, were starting to flare with these extraordinary lights. And I said to him, look at your vestments, look at the colours, the fluorescence and the phosphorescence in your clothing. And he looked down, he said, I don't see anything. And then he caught me, and he caught me by my hands, and he said to me, you, lady, you strong spirit. And for the rest of the day, he looked after me when I was filming.
Well, thank you for that. And So we have like 1 or 2 minutes left, and if you,
Yes.
yeah, sorry.
I know, this is desperate, isn't it? Terrible
Yeah.
situation. Now,
So,
I'm going to give you folks a list of trees to look after,
okay.
right? Please look after the Quercus douglasii, your blue oak. Can you please do that? Somebody there, some one of you, look after the blue oak. I want you to plant it. I want that tree going back into the valleys of California, and I want you to protect it. Some one of you, please go down through the valleys and set up a criterion for the best oak that you can see. And please go to the farmers and ask them if you can take the acorns from the trees. Now, leave them drop to the ground. You have to allow them to drop on the ground, and the leaves themselves fall on those acorns. And the leaves have abscisic acid in them, which is a growth regulator and a growth promoter. So allow that to happen, then collect the acorns, and then grow on the acorns immediately. And from that, you'll get the best germination for the blue oak. We have to save the blue oak for the Californian people and for our children. Then the next one is the Pinus sabiniana, the digger pine. That one again too has got that blue-green color, and it can withstand climate change. It can withstand all that the world can throw at it, and so can the blue oak because it has both quercetin in its skin and it also has the blue-green veil on the epidermal tissue of the leaf itself, so it can protect itself from climate change. So if you get these kingpin trees going as well as the redwoods, protect them. Then you've got kind of linchpin species all along the coast that will in turn protect the great waters of the Pacific and all of the mammals in the Pacific. So kind of follow up by watching the movie at some time in your life, and then you'll see why you're doing that. And California has got the most wonderful, marvelous botanical species. I mean, I am speechless when I think about them. Then the Arbutus mendiensi, the madrone tree. Please plant it for your children. The tree itself produces an extraordinary antibiotic in it, which will help your children, and it's an anti-inflammatory. It will protect the air around your children and your old people. So it is a member of the heath family, the heather family, and there are only 12 of them across the world. They are ancient, ancient sacred trees, and they were too once upon a time in California. So now look to the Australian species, and I'm giving you a little bit of thought here. The tree does not shed its leaves so much as its bark, and that's very, very similar to the Australian people. So some one of you out there, this is a couple of PhD programs for you. See, listen up.
That's interesting. Did you say that the madrones are part of the heather family?
Yes,
Wow.
they are.
There's lots of, if you go, like right where I live is redwood, but if you go about 10 miles east, because the coast, and because there's a coastal range here, it changes the ecology very, very quickly. And you move quickly from redwood into madrone, and there's tons of madrones not far from here.
Yeah, well, you go and you get all your friends to walk in there. I mean, in Ireland, we have only a few of them left, and they're endangered, and they're called Arbutus unido. And according to the Druids, unido is unum, Edo, only eat one. That's the message of Arbutus unido. And the Druids only ate one, and that's as an anti-inflammatory, and it's also to help you as an antibiotic. And it also helps with arteriosclerosis, and it is an antiseptic rinse. So it has arbutin, Arbutin, and ethyl gallate. So look those up. These are very potent antibiotics that cleanse the air around these trees. And so it's very important for you. You know, there's so many things we can talk about the species you have there on the California West Coast. Then the other thing you have too on the coast itself is a maritime meadow threading all the way up and down the coastline. And they're reduced species that really are really quite extraordinary in their biodiversity. My God, like I could spend my whole life there as a botanist looking at things. I'd be down on my hands and knees examining things. But for me, it's so exciting to be there. I mean, it's just, oh, I'd love to go to take a whole wallop of people on a tour up and down the coast, just talking about trees.
Well, I think what you've done with this interview is you have introduced a lot of people to that way of thinking, and I think that that's going to be really helpful for people, no matter whether they live in Nova Scotia or Baja California, or no matter where they live. I think that this is going to be incredibly useful and helpful both to people and the people who live and the forests in where they live.
Yeah, thank
so,
you.
So I would like to thank you for being on the program. I would like to thank listeners for listening. My guest today has been Diana Beresford-Kroeger. This is Derek Jensen for Resistance Radio on the Progressive Radio Network.